Chapter 18. The Lie? I Need a Drink. The first time I ever had a drink of alcohol, I was 15 years old. It sounds pretty scandalous, but honestly, it was basically harmless. My big sister Christina let me have a sip of her Midori Sour one night when I was spending the night at her apartment. She made it in a plastic tumbler that came with the purchase of Big Gulp circa 1998. So we were keeping it way classy. The drink itself was sweeter than Pixie Sticks powder and a shade of neon green that is typically only found in something radioactive. I was excited to try it out because it made me feel mature, but it certainly wasn't a gateway drug to partying at Studio 54. The second time I had a drink, I was 17 years old. My best friend Kim and I drank half a bottle of cheap tequila between the two of us. It was the color of maple syrup, the kind of high-quality liquor reserved for idiot teenagers and sailors on shore leave. We threw up everything that wasn't permanently attached to our insides, positive we were going to die. It's a miracle we didn't. It's also a miracle that neither of our mamas found out and murdered us in cold blood. Those first two experiences are pretty solidified in my memory because they were so out of the ordinary. Alcohol was never present in my late teenage years and only made a rare appearance in my early 20s. Oh, sure, I had some Boone's Farm just like every other poor, confused, college-age girl, but drinking wasn't on my radar. On my wedding day, I had a few sips of champagne. On our honeymoon, I probably tried some kind of blended drink, but that was really more for the milkshake quality than any medicinal aspects. In fact, I remember going to a dinner party not so long into our marriage, and another couple talked about how much wine they consumed. Dave and I drove home talking about it. "Did you hear how much wine she says she drinks? That's crazy." I sat atop my glass house and judged a behavior I couldn't understand. Then I had kids. Then I had kids, and wine became my best friend. Cocktails? They were like favorite cousins you only see on the holidays, which is to say, I only really got to enjoy them on special occasions. Is it funny or depressing to admit that before I had kids, I never really understood why anyone drank? Then, suddenly, I found myself exhausted, overwhelmed, and on edge. I discovered that I could have a glass of wine that magically muted the edges. When my older boys were toddlers, drinking became a regular part of my routine. I'd come home from work, change into my pajamas, because bras are the devil's work, and pour myself a glass of wine while I got dinner ready. When I was a teenager, I watched Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and fell in love with Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Newman fighting their way through a southern plantation. In the film adaptation of that play, Brick has become an alcoholic, and in one scene in particular, he's fighting with Big Daddy, played impeccably by Burl Ives, and arguing that he needs a drink. He keeps talking about a click that happens when he drinks enough that makes him feel better. My teenage self thought Paul Newman was really overselling it, that the description of that click was Southern dramatics. But then I started drinking wine in the evening when I got home from work. Without realizing it, I counted my way toward that click with every sip of white wine. Between the first swallow and the fifth, I'd feel myself start to relax. By the tenth sip, I was totally calm, able to parent my children better and more easily. One glass of wine at night turned into two glasses of wine at night. Two glasses of wine a night turned into a seven-day-a-week habit that increased in quantity on the weekend. Each morning, I would wake up feeling a little queasy or have to take ibuprofen to counteract my headache. Each morning, I would chalk it up to hormones or lack of sleep. I refused to acknowledge my daily hangover for what it was. At social gatherings or work events, I would pound a cocktail or a glass of the signature drink as soon as I got in the room. Being in a crowd made me hyper-aware of getting it right. I reasoned that if I was more relaxed, I'd be better able to carry on meaningful conversations. Alcohol gave me courage. It gave me the courage to parent. It gave me the courage to have conversations with strangers. It gave me the courage to feel sexy. It washed away things like anxiety, fear, frustration, and anger with juicy acidity and a balanced flavor profile. I'm trying to remember the moment I realized how unhealthy all of this was for me, and I don't have a clear defining instant in my mind. I only recall that one day I suddenly caught myself saying, "I need a glass of wine." As a writer, I pay a lot of attention to words. In this instance, on this random day, I caught the word need. Need implies that something is essential, necessary. So when had I gone from thinking wine might be a nice addition to my night to believing it was essential for my survival? The idea was terrifying. Terrifying because I come from a long line of alcoholics and I didn't want to become one myself. I stopped cold turkey, gave up any kind of alcohol for as long as it took me to realize I didn't actually need it. After about a month without any alcohol, and after discovering that the world would continue to spin on its axis even without it, I felt more in control. I would occasionally have a drink, but truly didn't feel the desire to drink when I was stressed. And then we had foster kids. That summer, we signed up for the foster-to-adopt system in LA County. We jumped right in. In retrospect, we were so euphoric about the time we had with the children, so eager to be helpful. We should have taken a step back before we agreed to anything. We didn't know that at the time, though. We were naive about all that was coming or how hard it would be. So we said yes, and we went from 3 boys to 5 children in the span of a couple of weeks. Those days were absolute chaos, in the most beautiful way. Dave and I were in straight-up survival mode. Our only mission each day and every day was to occupy 5 children between 6 in the morning and 8 o'clock at night. We ran around the yard, jumped on the trampoline, and spent hours and hours swimming in the pool. We navigated severe health issues with the baby and her big sister's trauma. We cleaned up 1,000 spills and kissed skin knees and reminded everyone to be kind at least 30 times a day. And at night, when they were snuggled in their beds, we drank vodka. Wine? Wine was long gone. Wine wouldn't even touch the level of exhaustion and fear and overwhelm we were feeling. Vodka was my co-pilot, and I was deeply grateful for its presence in my life. We began to navigate visits with bio parents and medical appointments several times a week. We became entrenched in DCFS and battled against a broken system we were inside of. How do you keep taking babies to see parents who aren't parenting? How do you give up half a Saturday to wait in a McDonald's playland for addicts who may or may not show up? And then hand over an innocent baby and watch them erase whatever progress you've made with their daughter? How do you do all of this knowing that they will be reunited at the end of it all? And there's nothing you can do about it. If you're like me, you find a way. But at night, when no one is looking, you drink. And when it gets really bad, you take a Xanax too. I look back on that time and feel sad for that version of me. I feel sad for the younger mom who needed her nightly wine and for the woman who was fighting so hard to keep her head above the water. On some level, I feel like there's a bit of shame as well, because if I can't be strong for myself, I at least want to be strong for my babies. I don't want them to know a version of me that used anything to dull the sharp edges. It makes me hyper aware of that bio mom I met every week at McDonald's, and it makes me consider her addiction in a new light. It makes me wonder if maybe some of you reading this now have your own version of this kind of coping too. Over the last year, I've gotten more and more emails from women who are struggling with how much they drink. The drinking isn't enough to be a real problem, they tell me. Yet. Right now, their family and friends think they're just the life of the party, or they don't know how much they're actually consuming. But they worry it's getting worse. They're gaining weight and spending money. Drinking is hard to walk away from because the action is just so easy. One sip, one click, is all that's standing between them and not screaming at their children. A little bit of alcohol will make the difference between anxiety and ease or frustration and contentment. For the last few years of my career, I've gotten notes from people thanking me for my honesty. I've heard that when I shared my story, other women felt like they are not so alone. Those women who send me notes about their drinking, they've done that for me in return. They've also given me a powerful piece of truth to fight against this lie. My struggle is not unique, and therefore there's nothing wrong with me. If there's nothing wrong with me, I don't have any reason to medicate myself. Make no mistake, drinking the way I drank is a form of medication. Life felt hard or overwhelming, so I put something into my body to make it feel better. But it was a short-term solution to a problem that was not going away. When the alcohol wore off, my problems were still there. When the vodka ran out, I still had to sit in one of the hardest experiences of my life. I still had to pack up bags for those babies and load them into a car with a social worker to head back to their family. Drinking can be an attempt to escape, but you cannot escape the realities of your life forever. In the morning, they're still there. Only now, your ability to take them on is diminished by the fact that your medicine made you sicker. In fact, there is only one way to manage the stresses of this life properly, and that is to build up a healthy immune system, for lack of a better, cooler description. Stick with me here. I promise these analogies will make sense in a minute. When you're born, you come screaming into the world without any real protection. Your immune system is basically non-existent, which is why warriors like me keep their newborns wrapped up like Eskimos even in the middle of summertime. As you get older, you eventually get sick for the first time, likely because you have an older brother who brings home some kind of virulent flu from preschool with him. Getting sick with something you've never had before can be scary, but it's also entirely necessary to build up your immune system. Once you survive, your body is forever able to battle that kind of sickness, and it can take on similar types of trouble because it's been through it all before. Occasionally, we'll get an infection that our immune system isn't quite strong enough to manage, so someone prescribes some antibiotics. Back when I was a little girl, they handed out antibiotics for everything. Tonsillitis? Antibiotics. Stub your toe? Antibiotics. Then, at some point in between when I was small and when I had my own children, doctors realized that if you took antibiotics too much, your body would never learn how to fight off anything on its own. Your immune system needed to be put through the test. It needed to get sick and learn what tools were necessary to pull itself out of there. You see where I'm going with this, right? The difficult seasons we walk through are how we learn to build up strength to manage any situation. The strongest people you know, they've probably walked through some pretty hard roads and built up the skills necessary to be emotional giants. When they encounter hard things, their seasoned bodies rely on the good antibodies they've built up to handle that sort of scenario. They don't medicate because they're strong enough to manage on their own, and they know that medicating will likely make them weaker. I had to teach myself better ways to handle stress and painful seasons. I had to teach myself better habits. Having a drink will always be the easiest way out. It requires the least effort but demands the most in retribution. Running, having dinner with my girlfriends, praying, going to therapy, or allowing myself to cry are the best methods I know of for building up the strength necessary to carry on. These habits make me strong enough to handle the hard stuff, meaning I don't reach for the easy way out. For the longest time, I thought I needed a drink. Maybe you have no idea what that feels like. Maybe for you, the drink is prescription pills or food or pornography. Or maybe right now you're reading this and thinking you'd never do anything so dire. I'd ask you then to take a good look at your life. I know many women who binge watch TV or read romance novels obsessively because in those spaces they are closed off from the world. In those spaces they can escape the hard parts of their life by muting them with distraction. Food, water, shelter, healthy relationships, those are the things you need. Anything else you insert into that category becomes a dangerous crutch. And you don't need a crutch if you're strong enough to walk on your own. If you don't feel strong, if as you read these lines you feel weak in your soul, I want you to ask yourself if you are pushing to find strength or if you're reaching for a quick fix. Strength is never easy to come by. It's like building up muscles at the gym. First, you have to break down the weaker parts of yourself before you can build them back up. The process is often painful and it takes time, often way longer than anyone expects it to. Just like with your immune system, you'll get stronger in one area and then something hard will come along that you've never encountered before. You'll have to learn and grow in a new area, which can feel discouraging if you've already walked through a hard season in the past. But fighting through those times is how you get tougher. It's how you become the person you were meant to be. Things that helped me. Number one, learning about habits. I read an awesome book last year called The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg. Turns out, so many of our negative behaviors, drinking, smoking, etc., are long ingrained habits triggered by a specific cue. So for me, I felt stressed out, which cued a bad habit in drinking. By identifying my cue, I could replace it with a better coping mechanism, which for me is time with my girlfriends or long distance running. Number two, acknowledging my reality. Self-awareness is one of the most important skills to acquire in the world. For months, I ignored the negative side effects of drinking until one day, I finally forced myself to acknowledge who I was and what was really going on. It's so easy to ignore weakness like that, particularly if it's wrapped up in self-care or coping. But you're never going to move past a problem if you can't even admit to having it in the first place. Number three, removing the temptation. If you're struggling with how much you drink, remove access to alcohol. If you binge eat cookies when you're stressed out, don't bring cookies into your home. Obviously, real struggles run so much deeper than simply having access, but it's much easier to fall into those temptations if they're sitting right in front of you. Chapter 19. The lie? There's only one right way to be. I grew up in Southern California, but I may as well have been born and raised in West Texas for all the trucks and accents and country music that stretched out along the dusty fields in every direction. Bakersfield is the name of the town that you'd maybe recognize even if you didn't grow up there, but even that is a long shot. I actually came home from the hospital and found my way into adolescence in a tiny town on the outskirts of the outskirts called Weed Patch. Weed Patch and the surrounding communities were originally established by migrant farm workers who traveled to California from Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl. Have you read The Grapes of Wrath? Or, more likely, did you ever watch the movie during 10th grade history class? Well, those are my people. My people are from Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Kansas. The generations before them are Irish and Scottish, which is to say, we come from a long history of strong, proud people who are deeply ensconced in their religion and the traditions of their culture. When you add to that the fact that my father was a Pentecostal minister and my grandfather was a Pentecostal minister, it would have been nearly impossible for me to come up into this world without some firm ideas about what it meant to be the right way. The elders in our community didn't point fingers at others as being wrong, but our community only included people who looked and acted and thought the way we did. We were white, low income, conservative, and extremely churched, with little experience outside a 10-mile circumference of our town. I didn't know that being other was wrong because I didn't know that other existed. When I was in junior high, I went to Disneyland to play fourth chair clarinet with a symphonic band. It was the first time I'd ever left our hometown without a family member, and the opportunity made me feel positively worldly. They say America is a melting pot, but Disneyland was a salad bowl. No one melted together. They all stood out in glorious diversity. I saw every kind of person. I saw families made up of every ethnicity. There were whole groups of friends waiting in line for the teacups, and not one of them was the same race. Two men were holding hands near the Matterhorn, and my eyes nearly popped out of my skull. Even among the people who look like me, the individual styles were beyond what I could fathom. Goth, preppy, purple hair, piercings, tattoos, I saw everything. It was my first real exposure to people who were different from me, and I hardly knew what to do with the sight other than to stare at them as if they were exhibits in a zoo. I suppose that there are plenty of young women whose lives are more closed off, more sheltered than my own, but it's shocking for me now to write these things down given the diversity of my grown-up life. It's been on my mind a lot lately. What I grew up understanding versus what I believe now. It's been on my heart because we're walking through a season of people drawing lines in the sand. As much as I hate to admit it, I understand those lines. I was once drawing them. A schoolyard segregated by everything from race to religion to the cost of the jeans you wore made absolute sense to me because that was all I knew. But you cannot claim a child's ignorance forever. At some point, you grow up enough to understand that many people here on Earth are different from you, and what you do with that knowledge defines much of your story. I've built a business based on the idea of community with other women, and it's a digital tapestry of people from all over the world. What I've learned over the years is that regardless of how our looks may differ, we are way more alike than we are different. The mamas who follow me in Dubai have a lot of the same concerns for themselves and their families as the mamas in Manila or Dublin or Mexico City. I believe the Lord gave me this platform to be a good shepherd to this diverse and beautiful flock. I also believe I can't possibly love them well if I first demand that they be like me in order to receive it. I am a Christian, but I fully love and accept you and want to hang out with you and be friends if you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Buddhist or Jedi or love the opposite sex or love the same sex or love Rick Springfield circa 1983. Not only that, I think the ability to seek out community with people who are different from me makes me a stronger, better version of myself. Trying to be in community with people who don't look or vote or believe like you do, though sometimes uncomfortable, will help you stretch and grow into the best version of yourself. On Saturday mornings, I go to hip-hop dance class. And just so we're clear, I don't mean cardio dance at the gym or Zumba, but a real-life, honest-to-dog, counts of eight, as fast as I've ever moved in my whole life, dance class. And I suck. I thrust when we're supposed to swerve. I kick when we're supposed to fall back. Imagine your Aunt Mildred trying to negotiate the dance floor after one too many Chardonnays during Cousin Crystal's third wedding. I'm that level of tragic. because it's so hard to pick up a dance like that when you have no experience, and because I'm surrounded by young, nubile, professional dancers who all seem to have it figured out when I don't, I, more than once, have questioned why I'm there at all. I'll tell you why I'm there. Aside from a deep and abiding love for 90s music, I'd actually like to be a better dancer. I'd actually prefer to go through the hard, confusing process of figuring it out and asking questions and seeking guidance than settling for the cushy comfort zone where life isn't hard, but where I don't grow. Maya Angelou said, "When you know better, you do better." I want to know better so I can do better. I approach my desire for community the same way I approach that dance class. I'd prefer to make a fool out of myself with the more seasoned professionals because I'm willing to stand alongside them and out myself as an amateur. I'd rather look back a year from now or 10 years from now on my uncertainty as I struggled to write this book than to only have written about easy topics because they were safe. My uncertainty is proof that I was trying to grow. We have to consider if there are areas where we stay safely inside the lines we've drawn, or those drawn for us by our family of origin. And how can we know the right community to seek out if we've never been a part of it before? Will you treat me differently because of one of my beliefs? Will you decide that we can't be friends if we have a difference of opinion? Ask yourself this question. Is it possible that the conversations we might have together, the questions we might wrestle with, the postures we'll have to adopt in order to engage in a meaningful relationship would help us grow into better versions of ourselves? One of my best friends is gay, African-American and Mexican-American. Three incredibly powerful narratives have shaped the woman she is. And there is so much strength, history, beauty, confidence, pain, empathy, anger, truth, and courage in her story. What if I'd never heard it? Me, the girl who once stared at a couple in Disneyland years ago as if they were on exhibit. Me, who once often used the phrase, "that's gay," as derogatory. Me, who used to live inside a bubble where I never interacted with girls who weren't white. What if I had stayed there? What if we didn't intentionally look for a church that was multicultural so our children wouldn't be raised with the same homogenized worldview that we were? What if I hadn't asked my friend to happy hour that first time? What if she hadn't been unendingly gracious with me when I said things or asked things that I now understand were hurtful? What if we didn't have the kind of relationship where she could call me out and lovingly explain why that particular phrase was offensive? What if I hadn't been willing to sit within the discomfort of working through a lifetime of unconscious bias? What would that mean for my work, my children, and what they grew up believing is true? Beyond just what I learned, what about what I received? What about the countless hours we've laughed until our sides hurt? What about the 9 million memes we've tagged each other in? What about the shoulder to cry on for both me and Dave when we walk through our adoption process? What about vacations and movie nights and that one time we saw Britney Spears in concert? It would all be lost. So much love and wisdom and friendship would still be sitting on the other side of that line in the sand. A few years ago, one of Dave's friends was in town with his family, and they were coming over for dinner. It was the first time I would meet this friend and his wife, and the first time our boys would meet their son. Their son is still, without question, the coolest person I know. We don't get to hang out with him often since they live in another state, but every time we do, I'm blown away by how funny and wise and strong he is. That first time, I didn't know much about him. I only knew that he was differently abled. I didn't know if he had a wheelchair or a walker, and I worried about how to make him feel comfortable in our home. I wondered about how I should prep the boys in advance, my fear being that they would ask inappropriate questions or say something unintentionally offensive to our new friends. Should I talk to them about his differences and explain that they didn't matter? Should I make sure that they understood that friends are friends regardless of how they look or get around? Should I explain everything I could about his abilities so they wouldn't ask more? I had so many questions and so much uncertainty as I considered explaining his condition to my boys. But then I realized something. I was about to teach my children to draw a line in the sand. I was about to point out the things that made our new friend different and therefore other. After all, in my own childhood, the invisible, enforced divide between us and them, intentional or not, made others seem wrong. So that day, I chose to say nothing at all, except that a new friend was coming over to play. When our buddy arrived on the scene, they thought his walker was the coolest thing they'd ever seen. They begged him to let them try it out. They ran up and down the hallway testing out all of its features. They never had a playdate with someone with different abilities, but that day, it didn't occur to them that it was unique. I've seen this happen again and again over the years as we've met friends with Down syndrome or autism or cerebral palsy. Their circle of friends is made up of every color, religion, and ability, and they come from every kind of family. Different isn't unique to them. Different is their normal. There are no lines in our sandbox. There isn't one right way to be a woman. There isn't one right way to be a daughter, friend, boss, wife, mother, or whatever else you categorize yourself as. There are so many versions of each and every style on this planet, and beauty lives in that dichotomy. The kingdom of God is in that dichotomy. At the end of every one of my hip-hop dance classes, the room breaks into smaller groups so we can watch each other perform. Every kind of person from every walk of life, and we're all sweaty and gross, but we sit down beside each other to cheer on the others. Imagine that. A large group of people who are committed to doing the hard work together, joining in to simply cheer on a community. You can see the beauty in that, right? That's not even the best part. The best part about this time together is the difference in everyone's interpretation of the beats. We all learned the exact same moves. Well, they did, but there's no telling what I might bust out. But every person's dance looks different from everyone else's. The girl who grew up doing ballet has movements that are more fluid and graceful. The guy who knows how to breakdance rocks a style all his own. We're all practicing the same thing, but we do it in different ways. Our different styles are beautiful to behold. What if we don't presume to know the answers? What if we're always asking questions? What if we don't settle for the world we feel comfortable with, but push ourselves to seek more? It would mean that we would find true relationship with other women at a soul-deep level instead of a skin-deep perception. We do not need to change our entire belief system to make this a reality. We can simply adjust our posture to consider a wider, more inclusive community. If we adjust our posture, it will change the way we speak. If we adjust our posture, it will change the way we listen. If we adjust our posture, we will see the person, not the category they fall into. This is true of race, religion, political affiliation, sexual orientation, socioeconomic background, and any other category we can dream up. Doing life with people who don't look or think or vote like us is the whole point. It's our call to arms. Love thy neighbor wasn't a suggestion. It was a command, you guys. How in the world are you going to love your neighbor if you don't know your neighbor? I don't mean waving hello at the grocery store. I mean actually pushing ourselves outside of our comfort zone and doing life with different kinds of people. Even if we wonder if they're getting it all wrong. Heck, especially if we think they're getting it all wrong. We need to be in a wider community not because we're attempting to sharpen their clarity on a subject, but because we're hoping to soften the edges of our own hearts. What does your story look like? Is it filled with all the same colors and lines? Do all the characters in your book look and act like each other? Imagine what would happen. Imagine how beautiful the same scene might appear, what it would mean for your worldview, for your children's worldviews, if you added different hues, different narratives, different dialogues. What would it mean to challenge your outlook every now and again? What would it mean for your relationship with your own understanding if you had to ask more questions? How would it affect other people's behavior if they saw your unbiased, open-heart welcoming new friends? What could we accomplish in our communities if we took all the energy that we typically spend drawing lines and used it instead to draw our neighbors closer? Every day, you get to choose the way your world looks. Regardless of how you were raised or what you were taught to believe, you get to decide where your story goes from here. Look at the pictures in your book. Are they all one color? Every year you close a new chapter in your story. Please, please don't write the same one 75 times and call it a life. Things that helped me. Number one, changing churches. Dave and I looked up one day and realized that we went to an affluent church in Bel Air and that 99.9% of our church family was white. This is not what the body of Christ looks like. The body of Christ is every color and style and background. By seeking out a church that was intentionally multi-ethnic, multicultural, and intergenerational, we were able to find real community. Number two, acknowledging my position. It's not easy to admit that you've done things or said things or believed things that were hurtful, particularly when you weren't even aware of them. But if you don't admit to the problem, how will you ever change? Look around you. How much diversity do you see? Are you surrounded by people who are exactly like you? If so, begin to seek new friends and experiences. Number three, asking humble questions. My dear friend Brittany has been an incredible teacher for me in so many ways because she allows me to ask questions about race and white privilege and unconscious bias that could potentially be hurtful in my ignorance. She told me once, "Rachel, I'm never going to be offended if you ask the question. I only get offended if someone who isn't my race just assumes they know the answer." So I ask questions, and I ask them humbly. Chapter 20. The Lie: I Need a Hero. At least one of my chapters should have the same title as a classic 80s song, right? Come on, don't pretend you don't remember that scene in Footloose where they battle each other on the back of a combine. It's epic. It also has nothing to do with this next subject, but I love to remember Kevin Bacon's illustrious film career whenever possible. Speaking of Bacon, I was a little chubby as a child. And not that one necessarily tied in with the other, or maybe it did, but I also wasn't what anyone would call athletic. I was the president of the drama club, a preteen who stayed in Girl Scouts long after it was cool, a card-carrying member of the FFA. That's the Future Farmers of America for any of you who didn't grow up in God's country. I tried on a few sports for size. One awkward year, I somehow made it onto my high school tennis team. But my only real memory of that season is the tennis pictures we took, where I had a big hole in my sock that I didn't notice until the pictures came out. So much for enticing boys with wallet-sized pics of me in my sister's hand-me-down tartan skirt. I was never more than mediocre at any sort of sport, and honestly, I didn't really mind. We all have our gifts, and mine are far, far removed from the athletic field. Then, years ago, when I was pregnant with our third son, Dave trained and ran a half marathon. I know what you're thinking, because I was definitely thinking it too. What kind of monster decides to get in epic shape for the first time while his wife is the size of one of those tiny homes on HGTV? Dave Hollis, that's who. He looked so good and had so much energy, and I was so jealous I could spit. While running long distance wasn't something I ever aspired to do, the fact that I couldn't do it because of my swollen belly irked me. The next year, when he planned to run the same race again, I jumped on board. The joke is, if you'd have asked me at any point in my life before then, I would have happily told you how much I hated running. But while I might not be an athlete, I am competitive. I wanted to prove to myself I could run 13 miles without dying, just as he had done. I wanted to prove to our boys that daddies and mommies can be strong and powerful. I also sort of wanted to see if I was actually lacking in athletic prowess, or if maybe that was just something I had always believed about myself. So I started training for a half marathon, which, if you're curious, is like running in sand while wearing a backpack full of pudding. Everything is hard. Everything feels awkward. Every single new mile makes you want to puke. But I didn't give up. And slowly, so stinking slowly, I got stronger and better one quarter mile at a time. As it turns out, I'm actually a really good long distance runner. I have short little legs, so Dave, or basically anyone, can beat me in a sprint all day long. But here's the deal. Very few people, and I can say this confidently, can mind over matter themselves as well as I can. I've lived through 52 hours of labor. I've built a company from the ground up using street smarts and the cash from my day job. I've built my life on not giving up on the goals I set for myself. So if I say I'm going to run 13 miles, I am darn well going to run 13 miles. That means when mile 6 hits and Dave wants to quit and start walking, I fly right past him, tortoise in the hairstyle. The very first half marathon I ever signed up for was a Disney race. As a side note, please, please, please do yourself a favor and make it a life goal to run in a Disney race. They have 5Ks and 10Ks and half marathons, and I don't think I've ever experienced something so uplifting and fun. It's important to note the fun element because I walked into that race that morning so afraid of how hard it was going to be that I thought I would barf. But at a Disney race, there's too much magic to barf. The races take place inside and around the park, so you're running by rides and princesses and floats. Other runners are dressed as Disney characters and stopping for photos along the way. It's just so joyful. Also, having run in other half marathons many times since, I can tell you that the encouragement in these races is unmatched. There is something so incredibly touching about thousands upon thousands of people coming together to run toward a common goal. There were people in wheelchairs and others who were severely overweight. There were people who were 85 years old and young babies being pushed in strollers. There were pregnant women, you guys. Freaking beautiful, in shape, pregnant women who were running over 10 miles with a full belly. I was in awe. Everywhere I turned, I saw people actively challenging themselves to be something better, and it was a beauty to behold. We were one giant, sweaty mass of hope, made up of people from all walks of life who dreamed this dream and found themselves on the road together. With that many people, it takes a while to make your way to the start of the line, but when my cue was called up, they started playing "A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes" from Cinderella over the loudspeakers. I know it sounds cheesy in the retelling, but y'all, I was bawling by the time it was my turn to run. I kept thinking, this is a wish my heart made. And for once, I didn't beg off or get lazy or stop trying. I did it. Running 13 miles is really tough. And later, when I trained and ran my first full marathon, I thought I was going to die. Straight up die. Sometimes, within the race, I'd see a mile marker and take a selfie of me leaping across to show how great I was feeling. Other times, it took everything I had to put one foot in front of the other. But it was during that first half marathon, mile 11 to be exact, that I struggled the most. I kept scrolling through my iPod to find a song that would fire me up, because at that point, I'd listened to or skipped over every tune I had. I landed on I Need a Hero by Bonnie Tyler. I love me some 80s music, and this one gets me going every time. It did the trick. I was feeling a little better and picking up my pace as I started to sing along with Bonnie. I Need a Hero. As any child of the 80s knows, the whole song is about her looking for a man, a hero, a streetwise Hercules to fight the rising odds. And there I was singing along at the end of mile 11 when I had one of the biggest epiphanies of my adult life. I don't need to find anyone. Right now, in this moment, I'm my own hero. It was a profound realization in my life. I had pushed myself to do something I never thought I could be capable of, and it lit a fire within my own soul. Nobody forced me to put in those miles. Nobody woke me up in the morning and made me research the right shoes or which goo packets were least disgusting. Nobody else got the sunburns or the blisters or saved up to pay the entrance fee. That was all me. And the things you've achieved, the big and little stuff that peppers your life and adds flavor, the achievements that have made you who you are, those are all you. I heard once that every author has a theme, and they basically just write the same message over and over in each book, despite the plot or the characters. This is absolutely my truth, even if I was totally oblivious to it at the time. Every book I've ever written is based on this core theme of my life. It's the lesson I've learned over and over again, so it inevitably weaves its way into my stories, and this book especially. It is the gift I wish I could give every person I know. It is the thing I wish someone had taught me as a child. Instead, I had to navigate life and figure it out on my own. It is the greatest lesson I have to give you. Only you have the power to change your life. This is the truth. I ran an entire marathon with Philippians 4:13 written on my hand in Sharpie, and I believe that my Creator is the strength by which I achieve anything. But God, your partner, your mama, your best friend, none of them can make you into something, good or bad, without your help. You have the ability to change your life. You've always had the power, Dorothy. You just have to stop waiting for someone else to do it for you. There is no easy way out of this. There is no life hack. Just you and your God-given strength and how much you desire change. I hope, pray, wish, cross my fingers and my toes, that you will look around and find an opportunity to be your own hero. Every woman should feel that kind of pride. But if you're seeking change, you shouldn't just want that for yourself. You should need it. You need to set a goal for yourself and then work your butt off to get there. I don't care if that goal is to pay off your credit card or lose 10 pounds or run an Ironman. You need to make a move right now while you're still on fire from this book about what goal you're setting for yourself. Then you need to go do it. You need to prove to yourself that you can do it. You need to prove to yourself that you are capable of anything you set your mind to. You have the power. You, exhausted mother of three who's considering heading back to work, but she's afraid she's been out of the loop too long. You, 50 pounds overweight and conscious that your health is in jeopardy if you don't make drastic changes. You, in your early 20s, who wants to love but gives away your body in order to feel connection and instead only feels emptier. You, who wants better relationships with the people you love but can't let go of your anger in order to get there. You, all of you, any of you, stop waiting for someone else to fix your life. Stop assuming that someday it will magically improve on its own. Stop presuming that if you only had the right job, the right man, the right house, the right car, the right whatever, that your life will become what you've always dreamed of. Be honest about who you are and what you need to do to make change. Girl, get a hold of your life. Stop medicating. Stop hiding out. Stop being afraid. Stop giving away pieces of yourself. Stop saying you can't do it. Stop the negative self-talk. Stop abusing your body. Stop putting it off for tomorrow or Monday or next year. Stop crying about what happened and take control of what happens next. Get up right now. Rise up from where you've been, scrub away the tears and the pain of yesterday, and start again. Girl, wash your face. Acknowledgements. First and foremost, I have to thank you, my chic tribe. Years ago, I started blogging about what I ate for dinner. And even then, when my picture sucked and I had no idea what I was doing, even then, I found a community of supportive women online. When I self-published my first book, you were there. When I nervously and awkwardly went on TV for the first time, you were there. When I tried Instagram or danced on YouTube or told embarrassing stories in Rach Talk, you were there. And now we're here. With this book and this platform and this incredible community of hundreds of thousands of women all over the world, and that's because you are still here. Thank you, friends, for showing up for me and with me again and again. I believe we can change the world together. I believe we already have. I am grateful, as always, to my mentor and champion, who also happens to be my literary agent, Kevin Lyon. Kevin, I'm not sure if you had any idea what you were getting yourself into when you took that first phone call with me, but I am so stinking thankful that you've come along for the ride. Thank you to the incredible, hardworking team at Thomas Nelson and HarperCollins for taking on this project. Thanks, too, for the cheddar biscuits and chips and guac and wine and desserts and all the untold snacks and group dinners yet to be. On average, I spend at least 6 months of the year writing and/or editing a book, which means 6 months of mood swings, outlines, verbal processing, and caffeine-induced hysteria as I work to meet a deadline. I could not do any of this without the help of an incredible, incomparable team at Chic, who keeps the train moving forward even when the conductor is in a fetal position in the corner crying over book edits. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone at Chic HQ who continues to help me build this dream. Endless thanks to Joanna Monroy, who has loved and cared for our family for years. People ask me how I do it all, and the honest truth is, I absolutely don't. Behind the scenes is an incredible, loving friend and sister who takes care of my kiddos when work or travel takes me away from them. Jojo, I literally don't know how we would do life without you. Thank you to my children, Jackson, Sawyer, Ford, and Noah. I'm so grateful that God allowed me to be your mommy. It is the greatest honor of my life. Thank you to my husband, Dave Hollis, who allowed much of our story to be retold, not just in this book, but over the last 8 years of public life, even when the retelling was difficult. I am blessed to be married to someone who believes as deeply as I do in vulnerability and the power of Me Too. Lastly, a significant thank you to my parents. I am truly grateful for the pieces I carry of both of you that have made me the woman I am today. Our life might not have looked like anyone else's. It was at times joyful and painful and chaotic and magical and good and hard. But I wouldn't change it. I am who I am because of who I come from. I love you both.
Why did you write Girl, Wash Your Face? And what do you hope it accomplishes?
I wrote this book as an answer to emails and DMs that I get all day long. I, like I said at the beginning of the book, I feel like so many women are essentially asking me the same questions or living in fear because of the same traumas or insecurities. And so I wanted to write a book that gave them an answer, but also gave them an answer in a way that was authentically me. So I love you, but I'm all about tough love. And I want to speak honestly and with wisdom. And I think the only way that I personally would be willing to be challenged by someone is if I knew that they had also walked through fire and come out the other side. And so I thought there was no way I could offer you advice if I didn't first tell you my story. So that was that is what this book is about.
Why did you think this book is important in today's culture, environment, world?
I think this book is so important for women today because so much of what we see and consume is wrapped around the idea of perfection. Everyone looks perfect, acts perfect, says the perfect thing. I feel like women are desperate for authenticity. They're desperate to connect with someone else. And it's not possible to truly feel connected if you aren't being honest. So I hope that when you read these stories, and I hope that when I embarrass myself over and over again, that it gives you the courage to speak your own truths into the world. Regardless of what you see on Instagram, I promise you that every woman you admire has the same kind of problems and struggles that you do.
Each one of the chapters in Girl, Wash Your Face goes into detail about an insecurity that you have struggled with. What was the soul-searching process of finding those insecurities? Were some of them easy to uncover? Were some difficult to write about? And were some almost hidden insecurities before you started really writing and thinking about them?
For me, probably about half of the chapters in this book are things that I've talked about before publicly or knew had been issues in my life. They were things that I had really worked hard to come through. So when I started to make a list, I mean, honestly, that's how I outlined the book. I just thought through what do I feel like have been some of my biggest struggles and stuff that you guys, I hope, can resonate with as well. So I didn't want to list out a personal struggle that made sense to me and like five people. I tried to choose themes that were kind of unifying for women, body image and parenting and your space in a relationship and the feeling of not being enough. I know that these don't just affect me, but they also affect so many women because I get that feedback all day long on social media. The process of actually writing about them was incredibly difficult. The chapters for me that were most vulnerable are the story of my brother, definitely the story of that first year with Dave. It's one of the hardest things I've ever worked through because I honestly don't think I had allowed myself to process how painful that was. And, you know, to be totally honest, him reading it was incredibly painful for him because, you know, you're like, remember I said, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. And Dave's perception of that year is so different than mine. In his memory, we were just kind of fooling around. And I don't think I had ever really let him know how deeply hurtful it was to me. So the process of getting through that stuff, talking about the adoption, honestly, you guys, even reading this audiobook, I am utterly like emotionally destroyed right now as we're at the end of it, because not only was writing it hard, but actually verbally speaking those stories into this booth have been really difficult. But to me, if, like I said, if even one person feels solidarity in that or feels like they're not so alone or feels inspired, I'll go first. I'm willing to be the one that walks through something if it might help you to walk through it as well.
Is there a current Diet Coke in your life right now? Some hurdle that you're trying to overcome, even though it's really, really tough?
This is so funny. A current Diet Coke. At first, I thought the question was like, are you secretly drinking Diet Coke? And I'm like, oh, I would never. For me, the current biggest struggle that I'm dealing with is managing the level of my schedule is so insane. I travel constantly for work. I mean, like, I landed at 1 o'clock in the morning from New York and then got up the next morning to come record this book. I'll be on the road again next week, and I have 100 meetings between now and then. And the interesting thing about my job is that it's about being on, right? So, like, your energy has to stay up and you've got to keep that going. And what I struggle with, honestly, is not falling back into bad habits. For me, we've talked about this, it's not a surprise, struggling not to fall back into having a drink every single day and emotionally eating. Honest truth, like, the last hour, I'm so tired right now. And the last hour, I'm like, if you just finish this, you can go get a burrito, which is so terrible because I don't eat that way. I eat so healthy. But my instantly I go, oh man, a burrito is going to make you feel better. So I don't struggle with Diet Coke, but definitely those emotional coping mechanisms that are not good for me are still there. And man, maybe they'll just be there forever. It's something I still have to fight back against. When I get tired, I sort of reach for the path of least resistance.
You are a busy person. Is taking time to do nothing still a challenge for you? How have you gotten better at it, and how do you still struggle with it?
It is very difficult for me to do nothing, mostly because I have an 8-month-old baby and 3 other kids. I've got 4 kids. So doing nothing isn't a struggle because of the emotional reasons now, as much as it's just not cohesive with my life. I think I am so much better at relaxation and really taking time to shut my brain off. I'm sure, like most entrepreneurs, I could literally work 24 hours a day. There is no end to the amount of work that I have to do. And I am very conscious of, like, after a day like today, I'm not even going to look at email when I leave here. I'm going to go, like, download A Vampire Romance with my burrito, and I'm going to self-care by just, like, doing something dumb and fun and relaxing. So, whenever I can, I sneak in those moments. But I think the desire to do nothing definitely battles against just the requirements that are on my life.
What's the most recent experience you've gone through where you had to tell yourself, girl, wash your face and keep on going?
Man, what a good question. What honestly comes to mind is writing this book. This was incredibly hard to write, not only because the stories were hard for me to tell and very emotional for me to tell, but because if you're working with an editor, you're also, you know, in copy edits or story edits, you're also experiencing other people's opinions of how certain things should be shaped or crafted. And that is hard when you're trying to tell your truth and your story. And there were so many times, I'll be, like, fully honest, there were so many times where I felt so frustrated with this process. And I cried so much about the back and forth with the publisher, and I'm so grateful to them for all of their support, but edits were really hard. And I think for me, I remember at one point thinking, like, I almost sent an email that was like, you're ruining this process for me. And then I realized, oh my Lord, you need to take a breath. First of all, nobody can ruin anything for you. Like, you are choosing it. You don't get pissed off. You do pissed off. And right now you're doing dramatic, like nobody's hurting you. So I definitely had to take a spoonful of my own medicine and talk myself down from the edge to get to a place like, hey, I want this book to be the best that it can possibly be. And that means that sometimes I'm going to have to receive information that I don't love. So that's the first thing that comes to mind.
In Girl, Wash Your Face, you talk about making a list of priorities about what is important to you, not to other people, but to you, and pursuing those priorities. Do you have any suggestions on how to sit down and start tackling that list?
When you imagine a better version of yourself, your dream ideal 6 months from now, or a year from now, or 5 years from now, does your current calendar Does your current to-do list, does your current priority reflect that? If you're like, my priority is I want to be the best mom I can possibly be, or I want to be CEO of this company. Well, what are you doing right now? What are you making a priority to make that your truth and to live into that space? So I don't think making the list is hard. I think forcing yourself to take the time and put intention behind who am I, where do I want to go, and how am I going to get there? That feels like the biggest challenge.
One way you discuss dealing with the painful and traumatic events and past memories is to talk it over with people you trust. Do you have a group of friends or family members that you share these experiences with right now?
I think that my husband is my biggest confidant. And for me personally, I don't have a massive, giant group of friends. And I don't tend to, I would say the circle of people who I allow myself to be vulnerable with is very small. My husband and my two best girlfriends, and that is really who I trust in those spaces. I have to really know you well and trust your intentions well to let myself get to that place with you. So I think that it's important to have someone. It's important to have someone to talk to, but I've never been the kind of person that had 50 people to talk to. I just have that core group, and that's what matters to me.
What's your current mantra to inspire yourself to accomplish certain tasks?
Well, I used to have a mantra, and now I have a tattoo. I mentioned this in the book, but when I went to that conference, like a year and a half ago, it was such a powerful thing for me. And the realization that I had been making myself small, you know, I think the only way to fight back against a limiting belief is with the truth. So what did I want the truth to be that was in opposition of this idea that I needed to make myself small? And my belief or my goal or the person that I want to be is an entrepreneur and is very successful in business and is a CEO and runs this company. And those are my truths. I live them every single day. And when you're at this conference, they ask you to give a name to like the alternative version of yourself. Like, what is the better version of yourself? Like, give that persona a name. And the name that I gave mine, this sounds so cheesy, but the name that I gave mine was Mogul. I run a media company, and a mogul is someone who's very successful in media. So I have the word mogul tattooed on my wrist, and it is a reminder, and it throws people off because it's a really odd word to choose. But it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks of it. The word is for me. So that has become my new mantra of reminding myself, that's who I am. I am someone who is strong. I am someone who is smart. I am someone who is courageous. I don't need that mantra anymore because it's not a mantra. It's who I am.
If you wanted someone to walk away with just one thing from Girl, Wash Your Face, what would you want it to be?
If you only take one thing from this book, I hope it is the belief that you can affect change in your own life. And I know that not everyone will swallow that and accept it as gospel, but I hope that at least a seed is planted. I hope that it at least makes you ask a question like, is that real? Like, could I really change? You know, if my marriage is crappy and not passionate and we don't really like each other, is that something I could really change? Can I really change my relationship with my mom? Can I really make more money? Could I really be a millionaire? Could I really buy my own home or pay off these student loans or have a healthy family? Like, could I really do those things? Yes, you absolutely can. And if you can't accept that as like the gospel truth, then I just hope that you start asking questions. But what if? Well, maybe if I could I asking, like letting yourself have permission to ask those questions is what starts to stir possibility up in your soul.
Just for fun, is there a character from the Bible that you relate to the most right now?
There's this great scripture in Esther that I've always loved, and I heard a pastor preach on it last year, and it really, really resonated with me in a way it hasn't before. But it was the idea of, for such a time as these. If you know the story of Queen Esther, she's asked to sort of stand up in a way that could honestly have gotten her killed. And she's sort of inside this royal family, and she has to make a choice, and she's being counseled and challenged. And someone says that to her, who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And it really just stuck with me, because a lot of times in my work, I know that if I say certain things or do certain things, people on the internet are going to be mean. They're going to be mean. And I am not impervious to people being nasty or saying harmful things. And so often I remind myself, you were given this platform for a purpose. Perhaps you are here for such a time as these. So that is what I think of. You've been listening to the audio production of Girl, Wash Your Face. Text copyright 2017 by Rachel Hollis. Production copyright 2017 by Thomas Nelson. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other books and audio products from Thomas Nelson, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at thomasnelson.com. Girl, Wash Your Face was recorded at Dion Audio in Tarzana, California.